Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order January 26, 2014, 9:01 a.m. With me today is Co-Chair Senator Hoffman, Co-Chair Olson, Senator Bishop, Senator Merrick, Senator Keel, Senator Wilson, myself, Stedman. We have a full contingent today. We're going to kind of pick up where we left off starting last February, talking with the Permanent Fund Corporation today about the permanent fund structure and the earnings reserve in particular. We will be working on this issue over the next couple of months as we go through our budget process and financial markets do what they do over that time frame and continually be updated by the permanent fund as we work to ensure that the earnings reserve stays sufficiently solvent to take care of the dividend stream to the people we represent, and along with helping us pay for our core public services. So with that, I'd like to ask the board chairman, Ethan Shute, to come forward. He's got some support behind him. He can call up his two lifelines as soon as or whenever he wishes and do the presentation in the format that they would like. And we'll stop at the end of, or pause at the end of every slide for questions. And we'll just work through the process here today.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Glad to see you all here this morning. And I will call Devin Mitchell up to assist me because we've allocated the slides between us and he was going to do the kickoff slides.
Okay, that's fine. I just thought it'd be nice for the chairman to come up and invite the executive director. So, Mr. Mitchell, tell us what you do and why we should pay attention to what you have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Devin Mitchell, Executive Director of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. And we have a presentation for the committee today that's comprised of three basic components. We have a board overview highlight section. I'll give a little bit of detail about the corporation and some of the recent events of the corporation. And then our Chief Investment Officer, Marcus Frampton, will give an update on investment performance and highlight some of the additional MIT4. Sorry, thanks. Got to work on my mic work. And so our third part would be Chief Investment Officer Frampton providing an overview of investment performance is where I left off. The first slide in the deck is just an overview of the corporation and the mission, vision, and fiduciaries along with the assets under management. So it's not just the permanent fund. We only have one asset allocation, but we have sub accounts that we also invest alongside the permanent fund. The most recent addition, the power cost equalization program, was moved over last year, $957 million invested on behalf of that program. The Alaska Mental Health Trust has been invested by the corporation for several years now, $727 million, and then the $424 million is really just a subcomponent of the principal of the permanent fund that is segregated based on the court case that resulted in the deposit being made to the permanent fund. The judge determined that to avoid the perception there could be a conflict because of a deposit into the permanent fund and a resulting benefit to the jury who are residents of the state, that there should be a carve out for this settlement so that it wouldn't impact the jury's impartiality. And as a result, it's been held aside and in the early 2000s started being used to fund the Alaska Capital Income Fund. And so it's funded capital projects in the state of Alaska since then. The mission, of course, to invest the assets of the permanent fund, we first of all want to keep the investments or the assets safe. We want to have the minimal risk required to achieve the maximum return. And so it's a risk-adjusted maximum return formula that we follow. We have a vision of delivering outstanding performance to with the investment of the fund for both today and future generations of Alaskans. And then with our fiduciaries are the Board of Trustees, which we have Chair Shett here today to present the following slides.
Good morning. So as you all know, the permanent fund was established by a constitutional amendment. So in Article 9, Section 15, don't really need to dwell on that, but you know that is the cornerstone of the fund and how we look at the fund as fiduciaries. It is a public endowment, and the wealth of the permanent fund is the responsibility of every Alaskan, and there's a key responsibility on the six of us who sit as trustees on the board for the permanent fund. So we view this as a relationship between us and key stakeholders, including the legislature as a body and all Alaskans who are beneficiaries of the fund, and that includes future Alaskans. And together we're in this to protect it for today and make sure that it's still there for tomorrow. On the next slide, just a few things. We'll start with the fiduciary duties. This legislature set out four fiduciary duties in statute at 3713.120, duty of prudence, duty of loyalty, a duty to diversify, and a duty of impartiality. APFC operates as a separate entity under the oversight of an independent board of trustees on which I serve and for which we serve as fiduciaries. We do honor the past, look at the sacrifice and wisdom of our leaders who went before us, who established the fund, who continued to put revenues into the fund and ensure that it was healthy today. And I think that's a heavy responsibility for all of those of us who are here today to look forward to make sure that future generations enjoy the wealth and the stability that comes out of our permanent fund earnings. As far as stewardship, that's the exercise we're in now. Ensure that we are prudently investing to maximize returns while taking as little risk as possible, and recognizing that there are real market dynamics, and something we certainly talk about and I tend to raise a lot these days is we can't look at the markets over the last 12 or 14 years as a great indicator, because basically, the cost of money was free, and all asset classes went up together. And it's been so long that it skews the data sets for some of the models and everything else. And certainly, people's expectations as investors is that the markets are going to always continue to go up. And if you look over a long enough history, that's certainly not true. So, what do we do right now? I'm not 100% sure. Anyone who tells you that they are is either you probably should take their bet, or maybe you should run away. Because it is uncertain times, and the view that we've had to work through is how do we prudently invest on behalf of current and future Alaskans in these market conditions. And then finally, public accountability, an exercise like this today that we're happy to engage with this committee, and we'll be later today with the House Finance Committee, engaging and talking through where we are and what we're going to do. And we also have, regular public messaging. We have financial controls. All of our meetings are full and open public meetings. We rarely use the executive session, and only for the very, very few items on which we are allowed to have executive session, like personnel matters. But we're actually there's a couple of us on the board, Trustee Richards and I, who are sticklers about ensuring that we as a body don't abuse that at all either. That we only go into executive session for those things that are allowed. And so we do the open meeting, and we make records disclosures if they come in. So we are very committed to public accountability, being reliable and honest and open communication with the legislature, the governor's office, and all of Alaska. As far as where we are these days, I'll start this one with, I recognize full well that, there's been a lot of public press lately on very few things around the board. So our strategic plan was dated and needed to be updated. The board is only six, so it's very small. It's actually at this point in tenure, very new. A number of the trustees have less than 2 years of history and service to the board. In fact, basically three or four of us only have effectively a year or a little over a year of service. So it's a very new board. And with that comes a lot of enthusiasm. And so as we engaged the strategic planning process, we had a lot of ideas around, you know, ways to improve and try to make better returns, and how could we tweak this and how could we tweak that. And a little of that got out in front of us. But where we are now is we have dialed a lot of that back, and we still haven't finalized the update to the strategic plan. But for instance, the first bullet here, well, let's start first that we are trying to build an organization that sets the standard for endowment-style sovereign wealth funds, which is what we are. If you look at, you know, compared to peers around the world, we are a sovereign wealth fund, and we are an endowment style of sovereign wealth fund. And so we are trying to ensure that we are building and sustaining an organization, the APFC Corporation and its leadership and employees, that sets the standard among our peers. And at some level, we're there, but of course, it's a dynamic and competitive world, and we're trying to ensure that we stay there. So on that first bullet, grow the fund to $100 billion. Growing the fund is good. Growing to $100 billion is great. The question is how fast. We do not have a specific time frame on that because in the not that distant past, we had a target that implied 3 to 5 years to get this $100 billion, which implied that we would have to do some very aggressive things. And when we got into the discussion and dialogue around that, a number of us were not comfortable with that, so we've backed that off to just a goal of $100 billion, but not on a set time frame, because we realized that we don't want to direct staff or give people the impression that we're going to Vegas with Alaskans' money to try to get $100 billion very quickly. We will get there when we get there. We will try to get there as quick as we can, but we are going to remain conservative and prudent in trying to achieve that goal. Second bullet is trying to improve corporate functionality. There are a few things in the way the corporation is structured and in the state employees that we have for employees that are have been challenging, and we're trying to, you know, think ahead to how these things play out. So I'll just take them and I'll summarize all of them, and then we can talk about individual ones. And if you have questions, feel free to, you know, jump in and ask me questions. The first is we'd like a little more flexibility around the executive director and chief investment officer recruitment. Right now, that's a fully public process, and we've gotten feedback that that does impair our ability to recruit and evaluate potentially good candidates that won't engage a fully public process like that, because by definition, they probably have a job, a very good job somewhere else, and if they engage a public process and don't come out successfully, that can often lead to trouble in the current job. Key person risk. We are well aware that we run a pretty lean organization here that's responsible for $80 billion of Alaskans' money, and for now and into the future. So we have been looking at, you know, what are the key positions and how do we support those and plan ahead in case there are succession issues, planned or unplanned. Incentive compensation. I would say thank you to the legislature for a couple of years ago allowing us to begin an incentive compensation program. We believe that that has been a key to recruiting and retaining key investment staff, and that's the key to having an organization that does the best with our money. So thank you for that. We will continue to work on tweaks around that. Evaluation of location expansion, that implies, you know, some discussion of we did open a small Anchorage office. There is at least an evaluation of whether we should look at other markets, global financial market type of places. That one is in a very nascent level of exploration, and quite frankly, I think most of us are looking at that as something off into the future after we see how the Anchorage office experiment works out. And then data management capability. We use a lot of IT. We need a lot of data. Need a lot of data security. And so we're carefully looking at all of the elements around our data management and the security and capability of those systems. We are advancing a comprehensive communications plan, trying to do a better job communicating in state for education and awareness among the citizenry. Trying to do a little bit better job on focusing nationwide and global, in part to help recruit professional investment managers, and in part to just foster an environment where more investment opportunity comes to the fund. So we are working on that comprehensive communications plan this year. And then finally, we are reviewing and assessing the optimal structure of the Alaska Permanent Fund, rules-based endowment practices and modernization. And this really is a way to say we're looking at the two-account structure and what does that mean with the earnings reserve. As we look forward, there are scenarios that could cause trouble if the earnings reserve were to become depleted in a tough investment environment.
Does that finish your slide?
That's the end of the slide. I'm happy to take questions right now if there are questions.
Senator Keel, and then Senator Bishop.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Welcome, Mr. Schutt, Mr. Mitchell. You talk about corporate functionality, and there was some time spent, maybe not this committee, but at this table, with some prior discussions about corporate leadership, and a lot of discussion about a perceived split between the investment side and the management side, and difficulty keeping the team together. Can you talk to us about how splitting that team up physically now, putting senior managers in different locations, is improving that problem?
Sure. So I think first, and I'll defer a little bit to Executive Director Mr. Mitchell to talk about the sort of one team concept, but it has been a focus of the leadership at the board and the executive director level to try to do things to ensure that the employees of APFC are and perceive themselves as members of one team. And that, you know, you really can't be functional as an organization if you have two teams and one perceives themselves as inferior to the other because of corporate culture or other things. And I think we've made great strides on that particular effort to make sure that everyone feels like they're on the same team, because it turns out that you have to do accounting and finance, and you have to have a middle office where you clear investments that are made by the investment team. And you have to do all these unglorious things that are sort of invisible but necessary to run the business. And we have to have as good of people in those positions as we have on the investment side, or, you know, the wheels kind of come off the wagon over time. And we recognize that, and the leadership, the current executive leadership, certainly recognizes that. And Mr. Mitchell and I talk about it, and I think that we've made great strides in that. As far as Anchorage and having another little office, we have a few people up there. It's early in the experiment, but what I will say from a board perspective and looking at it at this point is it has really helped us to recruit and in some cases to retain people that would otherwise go somewhere else. And, you know, we all live here. We all know how hard it is to recruit and retain staff. And if we have one more tool that keeps the professionals in Alaska, then the small consequences that come from having another office are certainly worth it, because I would love to have more Alaskans. We have looked at are there other functions in the investment side that we currently outsource to consultants or other outside investment managers to do on our behalf, that we could bring strategically into Alaska and staff with Alaskans. Because it turns out when we do that, at least historically, we've done a better job than when we do contract with a third party. So our investment managers have done better than their peers, and we save a ton of money, like a substantial amount of money, when we do it with staff as opposed to paying fees. So our at our level, I think at the board level, we are focused on what is best for the fund and what is best for Alaska. And to me, that is hiring and retaining people to work professionally in Alaska on our behalf.
Follow up,
then we'll go to Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be intrigued to learn more about about how that's helped. Because I monitored the board's consideration, and all the documents showed you didn't have a recruitment problem, right? You had some of the lowest retention and lowest turnover in history, the fund's history. You had a vacancy rate that would be the envy of anyone in the private sector, to say nothing of the public sector. I think you had three vacancies among the positions you were recruiting for at the time, total. So I wonder if you could talk to us then about the decision to go with the additional office you did, because as I understand the materials in all the board's packets, there were a number of reviews by staff that said there was no benefit to be expected from an Anchorage office. There was potential benefit to be expected from out-of-state offices, which the board is not considering. How was the decision reached to do the one that was expected not to have benefits?
Well, first, let's take the out-of-state office. That's something that, as I mentioned earlier, is in the sort of nascent stage and back burner for real evaluation. A commitment to let's start with my own personal opinion. I'm skeptical about the value of an outside office. And I'm skeptical about stuff and wrong about it all the time, but I personally am skeptical about the value proposition of, say, a New York office. And what I will say that I'm very certain of is that will have real consequences, because as you all realize here in recruitment and retention, we often can't pay market compared to like a national market or a big market salary for people for compensation. What we trade off is lifestyle and other things. People love to live here. They want to work for the permanent fund, but that only goes so far. And if you are in New York or London, that will go exactly zero for you. You cannot recruit and retain people at under market if you're in Manhattan. So it would blow our salary scale. We would either have to have a dual salary scale where now all of a sudden, you know, people in the new Manhattan office are making as much or more than some of our senior leadership, or else we've got to jack the scale for everyone. And we're not to a point where we see a value proposition, or at least I'm not on the board where I see a value proposition to doing that. So that's part of why we're not looking hard at an out-of-state office yet. I'm not saying that we won't ever, and it's on the list of things that we're going to evaluate, because sometimes I speak, like I've been very clear just now, I'm speaking in part as me, as one trustee. There's only six of us, but we are a body, we are a board, so we make decisions as a body by majority, you know, normal stuff. As far as Anchorage, let's start with what happened last fall, a year ago. You know, it was inelegant, right? It didn't come about quite right. There was urgency with a number of trustees to get this done, a perception that it had been dragged on too long. And let's do something, because we want to get people, we want to have this option. Now, while the data might suggest that we don't have a recruitment issue, it's not just in quantity, it's also in quality. Some of the, you know, people who've put their names in the pool lately have been high quality candidates, have indicated that they would only come to Alaska if they were allowed to go to the Anchorage office. So, you know, is that a uniform thing? Certainly not. Are there people who have to come to Juneau? Certainly there's still positions that are Juneau only. I would just ask for a little bit of patience around looking at how the Anchorage office plays out. It's been a very small financial commitment. It certainly had a little bit of an impact. We're trying to be deliberate around looking at that and seeing if it is actually working the way it was intended to work.
Thanks, Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman Schutt, welcome to the committee. Good to see you. Just real quick, bulleted, on this shakedown cruise you got going in Anchorage on this office, have you set a timeline and with benchmarks and where you hit a no-go decision on the office? That's just my question.
Let's remember to speak into the mics, please.
Thank you.
They can't pick them up.
Are you talking about a prospective look at to continue with the Anchorage office?
Yes.
Sure. I would say that it would be fair to let the thing run for a little over a year and see, you know, what the data suggests as far as the, you know, people who want to move there or require that as a component of their recruitment. And then we can compile. The best answer is to have data, and we need to have a little bit of a runtime before we get some data. I don't think that we're looking at doing any kind of an expansion into a more permanent and therefore expensive commitment. This is a very minimal financial commitment as far as the office. It is about as bare bones and unglamorous as you can imagine it could be. And it's a net zero to the state of Alaska because it was a building that the state was already leasing the entirety of. So we took over space, and it has an impact on our financials, but it's not on a net basis. It doesn't cost the state anything.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Do we have additional follow-up, Senator Keel?
Mr. Chairman, I think we can talk about who budgets the state's money later.
So on that subject, I'll put more of a pointed question on it instead of pussyfooting around. There was inquiries into the committee members on the before the Anchorage office was initiated, and I think the committee members were more cautious about that. We have a budgetary process that we go through, and we would prefer that we go through the budgetary process. And at the end of that process, if one or more or whatever locations are selected and it's in the budget, that's the process, right? So there was a little indigestion when the committee members, and I'll just express some of the concerns from my committee members, it wasn't delayed until we went through this current budget cycle that we're in now. So that doesn't sit well, just to put a point on it. It just doesn't sit well. And we've also are concerned that the directive to the administration of the permanent fund was pretty pointed from some or a majority of the board members to execute this, regardless of that issue. That doesn't sit well. So when we go through our subcommittee process and look at our budgeting, we'll take a look at that location and that issue, and I'll be asking the subcommittee to take a more refined look at the permanent fund's operating budget. Because we are the appropriators, and there is some flexibility given to agencies, but there's also the politics of making things run smooth and staying out of the gun sights of the Finance Committee, which is, I would suggest, is a preferred alternative, generally speaking. So we are concerned about that. And the handful of folks that went to Anchorage has a lower cost of living than Juneau. And most firms adjust their compensation package for the cost of living of their employees. As an example, the oil industry is based in Anchorage because it's cheaper in Anchorage to live than it is in Fairbanks, even though Fairbanks is a better location to the slope. But they don't have natural gas, and their costs are higher. So we understand that. But Anchorage's costs are lower than Juneau. So are we going to see a salary reduction for these folks that are moving to Anchorage?
I don't think so, no, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And also, there's quite a migration of workers out of the metropolitan areas ever since COVID. People want to work out, generally speaking, in the hinterland, and we're pretty much on the edge of the hinterland. So I'd be surprised if Alaska is basically red flagged as not a place to go for those that don't want to work in London or New York or San Francisco or San Diego or wherever, right? And I recognize that there's a lot of folks that like that type of environment, but there's quite a few that don't. So there is concern that the board did not go through the normal budgetary process. because we have generally been hands-off of the permanent fund, you know, at arm's length, and let the permanent fund do what the permanent fund does. And I think that's a good policy. But this was a red flag issue, and so you might want to take that message back to the board members, and we'll work through the budgetary process. I'll be asking the subcommittee to take a look at that space and the cash flow and where the money came from and how it's going and that whole litany of stuff that, generally speaking, they'd have better things to do or more important fish to fry. But this fish is already in the frying pan, so we'll work through that. And then on, let me touch on the growth to the billion. I do appreciate most, if not all, of the members here, because I've talked to most of them, that the permanent fund did not pursue the added leverage to try to have a targeted value of $100 billion or any other targeted value over a particular time frame. Because our concern here is cash flow to the state and the solvency and liquidity and long-term performance of the permanent fund. I don't think you're going to get a lot of support, and I think you guys made the right call. But those of, that are on the board that have a difference of opinion, we don't want the permanent fund chasing rates of return, because we could get in trouble fast if we underperform instead of overperform, right? It's a two-edged sword. Markets aren't linear, and we don't know what's going to come. And you referenced it earlier that we've had a decade or so of virtually zero interest rates, and times have changed. And we're going to walk into that over, you know, over the further discussions today. So I do appreciate that, and I would think the permanent fund should take a look at that in their strategic plan and modify that language, get that stuff out of there, because we don't want the retirement fund chasing returns. We don't want the permanent fund chasing returns. We don't want the risk. And as the public will see as we go forward, we have constraints on our revenue side in our oil patch, and the permanent fund just, you know, there's always challenges. But those are our two main revenue sources, so we need to be careful. And you referenced that earlier in your conversation, so I appreciate that. I just wanted to put a finer point so there's no confusion. Leverage is a two-edged sword.
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay. So we'll have Senator Merrig, who's in charge of the subcommittee. She'll be getting additional instructions from the chairman on things to do.
Understood.
Okay. We'll go on to slide 6, unless Senator Keel, you're done.
Thank you.
This subject. Senator Bishop, did you have a follow-up? Okay. We'll go on to more positive things to talk about.
All right. Well, moving on to the slide 6, we have we're looking at, again, on this theme of corporate functionality, looking at a couple of amendments to existing statutory constraints around records, and so we want to protect from public records disclosure the identity of all candidates who would like to be considered for the positions of executive director and chief investment officer, which allow broad recruitment and people to submit resumes and all the materials that go with that to consider these senior positions without all of that being put out in the full and open public record. Just as it stands today, when we do these recruitments, everything is immediately in the public record. And of course, we down select quickly to, you know, finalist pools to have a round of interviews and then, another final round of interviews and then, you know, evaluate with the board the various candidates. And at this point, in the way that the structure works, everything is public from the get-go, and we have had feedback that limits the pool of applicants that we get, because they can't really do that with the jobs that they have to apply to try to become a leader in our organization. So that's the purpose of that proposed amendment. And then we would like to have the authority to interview finalists for these two positions in executive session to where we can ask and get answers in a candid way that's not in the full public meeting format that we currently do. Again, to be able to ask tough questions and get tough and candid answers. As you all know, when it's a full public meeting, sometimes people pull their punches or really hedge the way they respond, just by the nature of it being a full public meeting. And then finally, to provide for confidentiality of the personnel records of the APFC staff, in a general matter, we don't believe it's appropriate for just general staff members, you know, some kind of a mid-level investment analyst, just because they're a public employee doesn't mean that their personnel record should be a matter of public record. So fairly simple, and I hope justified request to look at these confidentiality aspects of the current statutory regime.
Okay. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to split up the question because I think personnel records, I think you make a great point. But the other edge on that blade, when it comes to interviewing and evaluating chief staff, is that that's how decisions of the board come down. That's one of the ways decisions of the board come down to staff. And I've been concerned, as I mentioned, I listened to a lot of board meetings over the last several months. I've been very concerned with a real interest in secrecy. I think that decision about the second office appeared to have been taken between board meetings. There was open discussion of having an out-of-state meeting to avoid the Open Meetings Act, and I appreciate, Mr. Chairman, that you did not do that. Discussions of doing performance reviews only verbally, so that there's no written record. There is concern. It's a public fund, right? This isn't this generation's money. It's our kids and our grandkids and their kids' money. There's great concern about an apparent desire to reduce the transparency at the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation.
Is there a question there or more of a statement?
I can interpret a question or at least
well, just
issue.
Make it brief. We're going to pick the pace up because we're only on page 6.
I can, through the chair, I can see how you, well, there certainly have been things that have been said. And a suggestion, I don't know if it was a joke or a serious suggestion about having a meeting out of state so that we can escape Public Records Act. I don't think that is would do that anyways, but nevertheless, we're not going to have a meeting out of the Permanent Fund Board outside of Alaska anytime soon for a bunch of reasons. And escaping public view is the last reason. It's an inappropriate reason to do so. So we're not going to do that as long as I'm the chair.
Good. Okay, we'll go on to the next slide, please. And we'll try to pick the pace up. Normally we do an hour and a half. We got 2 hours a day, but we still want to get done in a lot of time. So you guys don't have to come back for more. Senate Finance on Monday.
I will be brief, Mr. Chair. You know, the purpose is set forth here. We need to make money, but we need to do it in a prudent way. We did not change our investment performance target, recognizing that CPI plus 5% over a long period is probably an aggressive target now. We certainly aren't going to increase that. We definitely considered decreasing it, but held steady for consistency purposes. I think that a number of us, and certainly the investment professionals that we have on staff, have the view that you can chase risk right now, but you may not be rewarded with any extra return. You may be just rewarded with extra risk. That is not the prudent course, and we are not trying to chase risk at this point.
So. Next slide.
So, Mr. Chair, Devin Mitchell again. I will be discussing the next slides. I'll try to work my way fairly quickly just because I do want to ensure that the CIO Frampton has a good amount of time to discuss the performance of the corporation. This slide just shows the progression of the asset allocation through time in the pie charts. You can see that we used to be all fixed income. And all of this kind of dovetails into the same story about the antiquated two-account structure that the corporation, or the permanent fund, I should say, has with the principal portion in the ERA, the earnings reserve account, and how that functions. And so you're going to hear a recurring theme. I think Chair Shutt touched on it. I'll touch on it. And CIO Frampton will touch on it as well. That our portfolio at this point, well, back in 1980, first of all, when you're investing in bonds and you're getting interest income on a regular recurring basis, it's pretty easy to have a realized return formula for determining what's payable to the beneficiaries of a trust. When you move to the portfolio that we have today, that's much less the case. We have around $13.5 billion of unrealized gains in the portfolio right now today, and that $13.5 billion, it's money that's already, from a GAAP or an accounting perspective, been recognized, but it's not available to spend because we have a portfolio that's not built around generating realized income. We have a portfolio built around maximizing total return. And so that's a big difference from 1980 to today. On the diversification side, in addition to the eight asset allocations, we have money invested around the world. And this is really, to me, one of the great success stories of the decision makers of the past, that we not only segregated this money, but we found a way to take a relatively small economy, resource-based, and make it not reliant on our annual funding, not reliant upon that, but rather from the world's economy. And so when you compare Alaska to other states, we probably have the most diversified revenue source of any other state when you consider that we have the largest contributor to unrestricted general fund revenue being the world's economy.
And just as a brief note, I think what executive director is referring to is the 5% draw rate is a different structure than the current guidelines. We're kind of in this gray area of the transition for the last several years.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. That I think Director Painter said it recently, that when you look at almost any modern endowment, they have a percent of market value payout that's based on a rules structure. That we do have in statute right now for the permanent fund, but they don't have this underlying framework of, well, you realize when you actually realize a gain, that's when it shifts over to the spendable column or not. And that's what right now we have half of the equation fixed. That underlying framework causes, like I said, if we have $13.5 billion of income, but it just hasn't been categorized, we haven't churned it correctly for it to become spendable, then that creates a cash crunch that is the liquidity problem that we've referred to last year and are again referring to this year with the earnings reserve account. So this is just continuing on that story of a renewable financial resource. The initial deposit in 1978, $734,000. The principal has grown to $56.7 billion on top of that $13.5 billion of unrealized gains and $8.5 billion in the earnings reserve account. The realized earnings, $85.4 billion, and that's based on deposits that are something along the line of $19 billion. I think it's on the next slide, the royalty deposits. But the use of those earnings have been the permanent fund dividend up through fiscal year 2018, $24.4 billion. Over the last 5 years with the POMV draw, you've seen $19 billion used or removed from the fund for those draws. And so you can see the enhanced use of the permanent fund by the state by just comparing those two numbers. You know, you have about 35 years or 40 years versus the last five, and the numbers aren't far apart, and we're going to soon, in a couple of years, have exceeded all of the prior dividend draws. And so use of the fund, it's become a primary tenant of the state's finances. As far as the other uses, 23.6 billion going to inflation proof, that whole intergenerational concept, which is critical again to the underlying framework of our current structure, the special appropriations to principal, when we've seen and this has happened multiple times throughout the course of the fund's life, where the earnings reserve account starts having balances that are so large that the legislature determines it's prudent to transfer some of that into the principal, and then the capital income account with Amarota Hess. This just shows the savings going back to 1978 and the deposits that have been made, whether from royalties and the $19.5 billion of royalty deposits. You add to that the $2.7 billion from the general fund, and so $22 billion-ish that the state set aside, and it's generated the $85 billion in earnings that I referenced on the prior page. So a pretty impressive outcome to the decision to set aside some money in the past. I think we talk a little bit about inflation proofing on this slide. That's important to cover that the inflation proofing formula from 16 to 2000 fiscal year 2016 through 24 would the total of those years inflation proofing per the statutory formula would be $12.6 billion. The actual transfers from the earnings reserve account for inflation proofing specifically total $11.3 billion. So theoretically, we're a little behind. But that said, with recognition that there was a transfer in fiscal year 2022, you have a check right over there that represents that transfer that isn't included in that formula or in that math. And so if you add that in, and you actually said that wasn't, if it was intended to be in a form of inflation proofing, then you'd actually be $2.6 billion ahead on inflation proofing. So it depends on how you view that appropriation, if it's categorized as inflation proofing or not, but that gives you a feel for how we're keeping up with that intergenerational promise.
So you're done with this slide? Okay, on that, just for clarity for those watching at home, when we put that appropriation in the budget, we had to put some controlling language in it, identifying language or what have you. And on that one appropriation, we didn't specify it as inflation proofing, but in fact, that's what's going on. We want to make sure over time the thief of the night, inflation, doesn't erode our purchasing power. So we'll be having further conversations later on in this budget cycle on this year's contribution, and we'll work with the permanent fund on that. But there's no intent in the long run to get behind inflation proofing and losing our purchasing power.
So again, building on the two account structure and some of the shortcomings, or just, I think it's kind of interesting when you look back through time, statutory net income is the realized returns and total return. And that's, this is on the chart on the left, the statutory net income represented by the yellow and the brownish taupe color being total return. And you can see that they don't, there's some commonality, but they definitely vary significantly from time to time. And maybe that's borne out just by the last few years' experience. In 2021, you saw returns of close to 30% for the fund, and yet the realized return was something around $9 billion, which wouldn't have it would have represented maybe half or less of that total return percentage. So it'd be something closer to 15%. In 2022, we actually had negative performance in the fund, negative 1.32%. And that year we had $4.5 billion of statutory net income. So again, it's a big mismatch between, and that's probably some of the residual effect of the largesse of fiscal of 2021. And then in 2023, we had fund performance 5.18%, and again we had statutory net income that was only $2.5 billion, and so there's not good, and I think Marcus's presentation, Chief Investment Officer Frampton's presentation, will highlight some of the reasons why that mismatch occurs. But it's it definitely is part of the story of why the two account structure creates issues for liquidity, for having money available to transfer to the state, not liquidity in the sense of having money available. We have plenty of money available. It's just not fitting into the right categorization in this old structure that we have.
Before you go to the next slide, can you touch on the real estate sales in 21 and how that distorted the numerics up?
The real estate portfolio, and again, Marcus would be able to speak to this better than I, but in general, the relatively high statutory net income that you see in fiscal year 2018 was over $6 billion. That was in part due to churn in the real estate portfolio. And otherwise, our real estate, the asset allocation has been building in size, and so it hasn't been a strong generator of significant amounts of statutory net income. We collect rents, but we haven't been selling properties, which is when you would really have the opportunity to have spikes in your statutory net income number. Otherwise, if you have a Tyson's Corner, for example, that has an unrealized gain of $500 to $700 million, well, it doesn't do you much good for purposes of providing for transfers to the state of Alaska or liquidity in the ERA. It does do good as far as, well, we have that value, but unless you sell the thing, you don't actually have the ability to provide a transfer to the state.
Okay.
And this chart has a lot of information on it. I think it's pretty important, though. The effective PONV, percent of market value rate, is interesting that while we have a 5% PONV, it's based on a historical market value. And if you look back at this slide, you can see that in 2019, 2020, the value was in the $65, $67 billion range. And then it spiked up to over 80 and then has been in the high 70s in 22 and 23. So we have a 5-year look back, and two of those years are a little more austere, three of those years are a little higher. And as that experience moves forward, if we continue having a fund balance that isn't growing significantly because of more moderate markets, that you'll expect that effective PONV rate to grow, so that it could become something closer to 5%. And if we see any declines in fund balance, you'd actually see it exceed 5%. So it's makes the number lower when you have an ascending value, and it's going to make that percentage higher when you have a declining or flat fund value. The statutory net income, and this again shows the choppiness of this statutory net income. And if you took the average of those years, it's going to be something closer to just a little over $4 billion. And you can see that there's the outlier years of 2021 with that almost $8 billion. And then in 2018, because of the real estate churn that you referenced, Chair, the $6.3 billion. And so if you pulled out those two outlier years, you have a statutory net income that's even more austere. The PONV transfer, you can see those calculations in the most recently completed year, $3.361 billion. That's gross to what, about 3.5 in the current year and 3.7 in the coming year. The inflation proofing in fiscal year 2023. And again, this highlights the two account structure and the difficulty. We had $2.5 billion of statutory net income. We had a draw of 3.3, so you already have a net negative impact on the earnings reserve account balance, the liquid portion under our state construct. And then you have inflation proofing of $4.2 billion. And so that pops your decline over $5 billion. So you have a negative impact on available money for state use of over $5 billion in fiscal year 2023. And that's the liquidity issue that we talk about. It's not that there isn't money available to spend. This slide shows the just amazing positive impact that POMB has on state revenues from a stability perspective, that you can look at the past years on the chart on the left, 76 to 2019, and the choppiness of revenue. You have the huge valleys and peaks, and the revenue derived from the POMB transfer, as shown on the table on the right, is an amazing stabilizing factor for the state that otherwise had this historically extraordinarily volatile revenue stream based on a commodity price. And there's the other great thing is that this is predictable. We already know what 25 revenue is going to be. We have to kind of put our finger in the air and rely on tax division to give us a forecast and hope that they're right and the futures market is right for purposes of determining future oil revenues value. But we already know 2025's transfer is going to be from the earnings reserve account to the state. This slide just breaks down the balances of the fund. So the total fund value is $77.4 billion. And this was as of December 31st. We already referenced the principal amount, 56.7. The unrealized gains that are attributable to principal, and we allocate unrealized gains based on pro rata size of the earnings reserve account or principal. So the pro rata allocation of principal is $12.2 billion. The earnings reserve account, it has a balance that's primarily utilized. The 2025 draws that is committed is $3.7 billion. The 24 inflation proofing that's in the current year's budget is $1.4 billion. The uncommitted realized earnings as of December 31st were $1.9 billion. So that was a $200 million balance at the beginning of the fiscal year with $1.7 billion of realized gains or income in the fiscal year to date. And then the unrealized gains that reside in the earnings reserve is $1.5 billion. And again, if we spend the 3.7 and the 1.4, that 1.5, the proportionate size will leave. So something along the line of 800 million or 900 million will leave the earnings reserve and shift over to principal of that unrealized gains if we just in isolation were to remove the 3.7 and 1.4 billion at July 1 or June 30, July 1. This is a historical look back at how markets cycle and the difficulty in hitting the CPI plus 5% target in any given year, that you can see, and this is a slide that we presented in the past, that era from 2008. And each one of these bars is a 10-year look back and an average to determine what the real return was, what inflation was, and whether or not the return objective, which is the gold dots, was achieved by those two things. And for those 10-year looks backs from 2008 to 2017, the performance did not hit the target. The years prior to that it did, and the years subsequent or after that it did. And you can see, and so it's this chart is designed to highlight that we could have long periods of time where it's difficult or the markets aren't providing us a means of hitting our target rate of return. And so if we don't hit our target for 5 or 10 years because of the market, that's something that needs to be considered when thinking about the permanent fund and the two account structure that we currently rely upon and what's an appropriate use of the fund into the future with that. This is our children's fund and our grandchildren's fund, and we're only beneficiaries because of our grandparents' largesse and the people that came before us that set this money aside for us. As far as the performance of the fund, you can see that the fund's performance, like I said earlier, is 5.18%. We did not hit our performance benchmark for the year. The performance benchmark was 5.74 and the passive index was 8.78. That underperformance, and again, CIO Marcus would be able to provide greater detail than I, but was primarily due to our public equity bent, that we're not focused on growth stocks. We're more focused on value stocks. And as a result, when seven growth stocks in the S&P 500 result in nearly all of the increase in the value of the S&P 500, and you're not a proportional player in those seven stocks, then you have underperformance. And that's basically, in my very highly summarized way, the reason for that underperformance in the 1 year. If you shift to the 3 year, which is more in our wheelhouse, we're not a short-term market investor. We're a long-term investor with that portfolio that I described earlier. We had a 10.49% performance relative and outperformed both the passive by a significant amount, over 4%, as well as the performance benchmark by over 1%. And that same outperformance holds true in the 5, the 10, and the 10-year space. In the 39.5-year space, we're right on top of our performance benchmark, slightly under the performance benchmark by 6 basis points.
Okay, before we jump into the next section, and we're halfway through our meeting time, and we're about halfway through the slides, I want you to talk a little bit about, in the event that we had another dip in oil prices like we had a few years ago, we do not have the balance in the CBR that we used to have, substantially less, and the market conditions that the permanent fund is facing are different. What's your thoughts on being able to assist the state in its financial obligations if we have a dip anywhere near the magnitude that we had a few years ago?
Mr. Chair, so I used to come before this committee as the debt manager of the state of Alaska, and so I have a pretty strong familiarity with state finances and the ability of the state to withstand shocks of the sort that you're revenue shocks of the sort that you're describing. And at this point, the state has much fewer options than it did in 2014 when the price of oil dropped from 106 to 25 in the second half of the calendar year, first half of the fiscal year 15. We had $16 billion in a CBRF. The state was able to rely on that account to get it through revenue years where we were receiving something around $1 billion for several years from our oil revenues, and that just doesn't exist any longer. And so if you shifted your eye towards the permanent fund at this point, we've already described that we have concerns about the ability of the permanent fund to provide for the statutory or for the transfer from the earnings reserve account because of the statutory net income issue that I described. And so adding on an additional reliance in a period of declined revenues, if it were, it would very quickly lead, and it would be, I haven't done an analysis on it, but off the top of my head, it would likely be no more than a few years, and you would not be able to make even the POMV transfer because you would have used the earnings reserve account to a point that you would just have current year revenue. So you would be at that point reliant on whatever revenue came in the current year and was realized. So realized income in that current year. And Marcus has a great slide on how income, what realized income you can take to the bank, you can rely upon, and it's something around $1.7 billion. That's like rents and interest income and dividends, and otherwise we're relying on capital gains. And so if you that would be your income at that point in the current construct of the permanent fund. So it would very quickly lead to an inability to pay.
And I think we wouldn't need even $40, maybe in the 50 range or something. We'd be pickled pretty fast. So what you're trying to tell us, if we overdraw the 5%, we're going to have more risk exposure or less risk exposure?
Again, I heard Director Painter say that the states always responded when financial crises have arisen and doesn't allow for or hasn't allowed for us to create a, what do you call it, a whirlpool or a drain effect. And so it would be reliant on the leadership to recognize the deficiencies. But if you start drawing from the permanent fund in an unsustainable way, you're very quickly not going to have the permanent fund as an option either.
So what you're trying to tell me, in the $70 range that we're at today, where we could possibly have a balanced budget, if we overdraw the earnings reserve when we can meet our obligations, the light's going to be turned out a lot quicker when the direction reverses and we have a declining oil price.
I think I agree with what you said.
Yeah. Exactly. Point being, we need to not overdraw the permanent fund just because we have the ability to do so, and we better start thinking ahead a little bit. This committee does. Not all members in the legislature do that. That's the point. So we'll work on that as we go forward and put a finer point on that. So we'll go into the next section. We've got about 50 minutes, so... and we're going to have you guys back later on as we get into the budget process to refine some of these numbers, so we don't have to get, we're not going to try to get everything answered today.
Good morning, Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Marcus Frampton. I'm the Chief Investment Officer for APFC. So I'm going to run through some of the investment portfolio aspects of the permanent fund. I'll just start on this page 16 that Devin left on. In terms of managing the portfolio, we really look day to day at the performance benchmark. So each of our asset classes has a benchmark that represents the broad opportunity set in that area, and then they add up to the total fund benchmark and how we do. The passive index is worth looking at because the performance benchmark has areas like real estate and private equity that an investor couldn't invest in at very low cost passively. So passive, Vanguard Group is perhaps the best known advocate for passive investing, is just very low cost accessing stocks and bonds. And so when we think about the passive index and how we've done, I think the committee and the public should look at that over long periods. Does the complexity and the staff we have and all the things we're doing, are those adding value against what you could just do with the most basic portfolio of stocks and bonds? And so over the long term, we've outperformed both of those measures. Last year was a disappointing year in terms of performance, and it did center in the public equity area. The rest of our portfolio as a whole did beat their benchmark. And I just wanted to comment on how we think about the sizing of investment positions we make, because last year, how we felt about the large, fairly expensive growth technology stocks hurt us. We felt like they were overvalued. We wanted to de-emphasize them. But in terms of how you size that position is really important. We have a risk limit where we can't take what's known as a tracking error in public equity of more than 4%. And the way a layman should think about that is that's a statistical measure where if we get all our bets right, you should expect that we'll beat by our index by 4%. If we get them wrong in that area, we'd underperform by about 4%. It's a little more complicated than that, but it's quantifying the size of your bets or your investment positions by how you'll do if you get it right or wrong. We've been running at about a 2% tracking error in public equity, and that's what we had last year. And we underperformed by about 2% last year in public equity because of that sizing decision that we made. And we still feel like the large, I'm talking about the NVIDIAs, the Googles, are just very expensive stocks right now, and we're de-emphasizing them. And the magnitude with which that's played into our portfolio in the last year is well within our expectations. And I just want everyone to have confidence that we have risk limits on everything we're doing. And even though last year was kind of a disappointing year, it played out as one would expect that would play out with hindsight. And then over longer and we believe that over time, we have a history of making these relative value determinations, and they generally work out for us over 2, 3, 4, 5 year period, and that's reflected in those longer term numbers. So that was the June 30 numbers. I wanted to just give as good of a update snapshot on performance as I could. I've got September and November. The reason I have September and November is we closed the books on our private investments, which are upwards of 40% of the fund now, so really meaningful on a quarterly basis, but not monthly. So things have improved fiscal year to date. September, with all our asset classes closed, we're beating our performance benchmark by about 70 basis points, so 0.7%. And the public markets were real difficult in the first fiscal quarter, and you can see the passive stocks and bonds were down 3.6. All that kind of turned around in the quarter end of December. So you see, as of November, the fund was up 1.65 fiscal year to date, and then subsequently, I don't have the numbers yet on December, but the markets were very strong, and the fund was up over 2% just on rough math. So as of December, the fund's up about 4% fiscal year to date and beating our benchmarks. I think we've had a real deliberate approach to thinking about external management versus internal management. And I think we have a pretty efficient and lean team compared to what I see in the industry. So on the left there, I've quantified it, or that's showing our investment staff by asset class. So there's 26 positions on that page. We've actually hired 2 people after we did that slide. That slide's a couple weeks old, so it's 28 today, 7 in private equity. And then on the right, I just wanted to comment on how we think about, in a deliberate and prudent fashion, bringing strategies in-house. So almost every year for the last 5 years, we've taken an area of the portfolio and thought about, can we do it better in-house? The most recent you can see on there is international equities. So in 2014 and 2021, we developed investment strategies where we would trade stocks that are U.S. domiciled internally. And as of today, 100% of the instances where we're trading in Europe, Asia, Latin America is with external partners. There's more operational complexity and more investment complexity, but we think we have a plan that we'll go live on in the next few months to start a program to trade international stocks. Our average public equity stock manager fee is somewhere around 25 basis points, so a fourth of a percent. And in the aggregate, that adds up to over $100 million a year. So there's real savings as we can bring programs internally, but we want to make sure we're very deliberate about it, with equities being the most recent area.
You're done with the slide?
Yes, I am.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Frampton, I'm probably just missing a technical term. Private equities in the pie chart on the left, where is it in the time frame on the right? When did we bring private equity in-house?
Thank you, Senator Keel, for the question. In private equity, we do a mix of internal and external. I joined the fund in 2012, and 100% at that time of what we did in private equity was working with a consultant to select funds to invest in. And around that time in 2012, we brought decision-making around selecting the funds internally. So prior to 2012, non-permanent fund staff decided what funds to do. Around 2012, we started selecting funds. I wouldn't call that internal, but it's more internal than paying a consultant to pick funds. Also, so a year after that, in 2013, we started a program to make direct investments. And we had a series of very successful biotech direct investments where we would invest directly in companies with venture capitalists in promising companies, and that was a very successful program. We also, around that time, made an investment in a company called American Homes for Rent, where we invested $700 million and owned 50% of the company. So that's direct private equity. Along this whole time frame, we've maintained programs where we have consultants that help us pick funds, and we make direct investments and co-investments. And so it's not a precise answer when we brought it in-house, because today it's not fully in-house. But in 2013, we made major strides in cutting out the levels of intermediaries.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go ahead and continue.
This slide outlines how we've done against other large public funds in the United States. So these are the, generally speaking, the other state pension funds. And the permanent fund's done very well. On any of the time periods over the last 20 years, with the exception of the last year where I pointed out I was disappointed in our performance, we've been top decile or top quartile. So that's the other, we don't manage against peers because we have different asset allocations and different programs, but I think it's worth taking a look at this data from time to time to see how we're stacking up. I think a real thing that we've benefited from is a very long tenure on the investment staff. So this page, I've just outlined, you know, the folks that lead each of our investment areas that report to me. I would say that, you know, every year we probably lose one person that we'd prefer not to lose out of a staff of about 28. So I think that's pretty low turnover. I think that's one of the reasons why we've been successful. The newest person on this slide is Alan Waldrop. We had our head of private equity leave about 2 years ago. That position was vacant for about 6 months until we recruited Mr. Waldrop. And he's an example of kind of how we recruit. Most of the investment staff we hired do come from the private sector, with some exceptions, but Alan's a guy who's worked in the industry for close to 30 years, and he was a private equity consultant to the permanent fund going back 10 years. We were able to convince him that this was a good career move for him. So we were really fortunate with that hire. I wanted to highlight how we make investment decisions. So we have what's called an investment committee, and we have three voting members. So that's myself, Jim Parise, the deputy CIO, and Mr. Waldrop is the third voting member. So if we have a discrete decision, like do we buy a building, do we commit money to a private equity fund, the three of us review it as majority vote. And then once that's been passed by the investment committee, it's reviewed by the executive director. So I think we've got a pretty robust, key person risk is something we're focusing on in the strategic plan, but I think we're building from a place where we've got good redundancy and some good long tenured staff.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll send this one to Mr. Mitchell. Do you see a trend on the exit surveys why people are leaving and
so again, Devin Mitchell for the record, through the chair, Senator Bishop. I think there's been a variety of reasons people have left the firm. There's been on specific to the investment team, I think there's been post-COVID more flexibility in a lot of workspaces, and we have some greater flexibility in our workspace as well. As an example, Director Waldrop, he lives in California. And so we have some employees that work remotely, and we had one of our investment team that wanted to work remotely, and their position was determined not to be appropriate for that, and so they wound up leaving the firm. I've had a couple of folks leave on the operations side because of better opportunities, and to me, I view the permanent fund, and people look at us and say, oh, well, some of the folks are paid well at the permanent fund, and I believe that we are, but I don't think that's inappropriate. I think that we should be attracting the best talent that we can both from in the state as well as outside the state when needed, and that we want to be able to retain employees. And yeah, we lost a couple of staff recently, and it's great that they had other opportunities, but one of our admin team left for a significant increase in pay, and one of our communications team left for an increase in pay. So the reasons that people have left, in my view, focus around, and I guess our HR director also left the firm for an increase in pay. But the primary reason folks have left the firm in my tenure has been either increased economic opportunity through a promotion of some sort, or that they wanted greater flexibilities, or they didn't want to live in Alaska any longer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for that answer.
Go ahead and continue on page 22.
All right. Thank you. I have a series of slides now that go through how we generate statutory net income and some of the aspects of unrealized gains in the portfolio. The data on this page was on a prior slide. I've laid it out a little bit differently. It just highlights where we have fund balances and then how those unrealized gains break down. So the portfolio today has $13 billion of unrealized gains. That number is really important because unrealized gains become realized gains, and only realized gains drive statutory net income. So if we had no unrealized gains on the page, it would be a worse outlook for statutory net income in ensuing years. Because we have $13 billion of unrealized gains, as we exit investments, that will flow to statutory net income. That's the good part. The tougher part is that 70% of the unrealized gains are in our private market asset classes, and they're just much more unpredictable on how they flow to gains than stocks and bonds, which we control. And so I've got some analysis of that on later slides. But I wanted to highlight that, and I also just wanted to highlight that we have the same asset allocation across the fund. We don't have the earnings reserve account like invested in bonds and all the stocks and private equity and the principal. So every asset is smoothed across the same asset allocation between principal and earnings reserve. So this slide highlights historical statutory net income. And it's highly variable, as you can see. And there are years with negative statutory net income, like 2009. That can occur if the stock market goes down and we're having to sell stocks, we're realizing losses, not gains, and that results in a negative statutory net income. On a later slide, I break down recent gains by asset class, so I'll comment on the 2018 and 2021 when I get to that slide. But they were fairly unusual years for a number of reasons that I'll get into. And when you look at how the levels that we've achieved of statutory net income versus the forecasts are higher than what we've historically had. They're based on the best outlook that Cowen Associates has, and I think good reasoning, but as you can see in the history, the number moves around quite a bit, and I'll quantify some of that here in a second. So there are two components of statutory net income. One I call baseline statutory net income, and so that is just regular dividends, interest, and rental income that we can expect with high certainty from the portfolio. And this slide lays out that aspect of statutory net income and how it's trended over time. We're running at about $1.7 billion, $1.6 billion a year in that baseline number. And the number as a percentage of the fund has declined over time as we've reduced how much we have in fixed income. Fixed income is the real big workhorse of this baseline number because of that interest that they get there. So when we think about the forecasts are in the range of $5 billion a year of statutory net income, and it's probably about $1.6 billion from this and $3-4 billion roughly from realized gains, which I'll cover now. This page gets into that, and 2021 was a remarkable year. So in the fiscal year ended June 2021, our stock index that we tracked and managed money against was up 50% that year. And the investment staff did not want to be overweight stocks. So every time that our allocation got over our target for stocks, as the market went up, we would trim. And we were just realizing gains the entire time as we trimmed. And so you can see there we got close to $6 billion of realized gains from our stock portfolio in 2021. That's really come down. As we sit right now, we have about $4 billion of unrealized gains. So if we just liquidated our entire stock portfolio today, we wouldn't get the $6 billion of gains that we achieved in fiscal 21. And then we also had very strong private equity exits. That's that orange bar that contributed over $1 billion that year, largely exits of companies that we don't control, that funds control, taking them public, selling them. And fiscal year 18 was the other really strong year for realized gains. We sold a real estate portfolio, as was discussed, but it actually was the third biggest contributor that year from an asset class standpoint. We had exited a company called Juno Therapeutics. I mentioned that we had been active in biotech. We had over $1 billion gain just in one company that year that we exited. And then it also, 2018 was a very strong year in the stock market, and we were doing what I described we did in 21 of always trimming when we went over allocation. So those are kind of outlier years. We've had a little headwind the last few years. You see that green bar, that's a negative number in 22 and 23. That's fixed income. As rates went up, the value of the bonds that we hold went down. And as we turn over that portfolio, we're realizing losses. And now that's ebbed a little bit and hasn't been a big contributor fiscal year to date. So there's a, I guess my takeaway is that it's very lumpy. It's very episodic. How the realized gains work out. I think Callan's forecast of over $3 billion a year in realized gains is the best base case someone could come up with. But there's more of a variability on this metric than you would see on the interest, dividends, and rental income. This is another metric that I track, and I believe Mr. Painter tracks in his modeling of the earnings reserve account. I've looked at the Ledge Finance earnings account model, and I think it's spot on. Like, I think he really captures the essence of how it works. This is a key driver. This is the rate with which the permanent fund has turned unrealized gains into realized gains for purposes of statutory net income. And it's declined in recent years as the percentage of unrealized gains has been shifted more into the private asset classes. So, like, the last couple years, we've had very high unrealized gains in privates, and the exits from the private equity firms have been diminished. Last year we were 6% of our unrealized gains were realized, whereas the long-term average is more like 20%. Which is probably a good number for modeling, but can move around quite a bit.
So this final slide is just a wrap-up page letting you know that we're in a long-term game that we approach our job with the long view. We're looking for base hits rather than home runs on a regular basis, and that we're looking, I think I said it earlier, but to honor the generations of the past that created this resource that we're using or investing to provide for both today as well as the future of the state of Alaska. And really appreciate the opportunity to come before the committee, and happy to follow up as needed in the future if there are additional requests.
Do you have any questions or final thoughts from committee members? I've just got a couple. We didn't have the chance this morning to go over the in-state investment issues. We'll do that at a later date, some point. This is an update, and then I'd like to the board, and I recognize there's a lot of new members on the board, and maybe that's one reason why we have this little hiccup in the location in Anchorage, due to just maybe a little bit of lack of experience, I hope. But it'd be nice to have a conversation at the board about the difference or the lack of matching the goals of the legislature in meeting its obligations and the goals of the permanent fund, just maximizing return on a risk-adjusted basis. Right? We have this anomaly of these old statutes driving statutory income, and then we've got the newer statutes of 5%, and then on top of that, we have the shift into the illiquid investments, and at some point, we got to try to balance things out till we can get to the point where we can have a constitutional change and go to a full endowment. So I'd just like the chairman to kind of relay that back to the other committee or the board members that we might have to have a little political dance for a couple of years while we work through this situation before we can get to the constitutional amendment, so we don't get ourselves in a bind. And then also I'd like to have the executive director back at some point, probably in March or sometime. We'll work with you on the schedule so we can update what things look like at the permanent fund, along with we'll have our revenue spring update on March 15th. So somewhere in there, we'll have to put up our bookends of revenue and expenditures and stay within those bookends. And the permanent fund obviously is pretty predictable because of the five-year look back, but we've got the earning reserve component that I want to blend into that, or the committee would like to blend into that conversation and balance that. So just kind of coming attractions as we work together through the budget cycle. And hopefully, one other quick note at the end, hopefully in the presentation this afternoon, you can emphasize the significant risk increase on an overdraw of the earnings reserve in a year where we could actually balance the budget without even thinking about that, and the impact or the additional risk exposure we face over the next couple of years in the event we have any fluctuation in oil prices. And that's about as certain as fluctuation in financial markets, just a matter of what direction. So I think that I would like to see you emphasize that point, because there is, I would guess, and I haven't been updated by all my committee members, but I would be shocked if there's any member sitting at this table that wants to overdraw their earnings reserve and walk ourselves into that risk exposure increase. So that would be helpful if you can emphasize that a little bit so people grasp what we're dealing with and we can just have smooth financial sailing. It would be helpful. Any other comments, Senator Bishop?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Mitchell, Chair Schutt, and Mr. Frampton. Thank you guys for coming today. But I just want to touch on a point. You said, you know, you got some new board members, and this picture here on the last page, that started it all. And you had some new board members. You had mentioned that. It might be fitting to talk about going to Prudhoe Bay this winter and tour the renaissance and almost deja vu scenario that's going on the North Slope right now with our oil field production that's going to keep feeding this fund. So these newer people understand where it came from, right? Just a suggestion. I'd like to say I just appreciate your comments on Chair Schutt, on being prudent and no set time on achieving your target of $100 billion. And I wish you guys all the best. Thank you.
Just one quick one. Is Senator Bishop, are you in this photo?
No, but Mr. Chairman, I can tell you that's a block on a 594 pipe layer, and that's a lower and end belt.
Well, with that, that'll conclude our meeting today. I would like to thank the Permanent Fund and the chairman to come forward. And we had some, you know, uncomfortable questions for you, I'm sure. It's just part of the game, or the structure, I should say, of our oversight duties. Sometimes we just have to lay it on the table and make sure it's clear what our concerns are. So this will conclude the meeting today. Monday morning, 9 a.m., we'll reconvene. Senator Olson will chair. We're going to bring up two pieces of legislation, Senate Bill 127, taxation on vehicle rentals and subpoenas, and Senate Bill 170, extend senior benefit payment programs. So we'll go over that along with bills previously heard as a standard position on the schedule. So with that, thank everybody for coming today. We are adjourned at 10:36. We're adjourned.